Welcome to Voices of NCAJ. We're talking to members of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice about what it means to be a trial lawyer, what it takes to be great at the practice of law, and how being a part of NCAJ enriches their lives and careers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everyone, to Voices of NCAJ, the podcast for the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. I am Amber Nemec, your host and Director of External Affairs for NCAJ. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's episode sponsor, Advocate Capital. Advocate is passionate about helping plaintiffs' attorneys get better results for clients, mainly through their AdvoTrack case expense funding service. It allows firms to track case expenses and recover borrowing costs, which makes the net cost of borrowing zero on cases they win. You can learn more at advocatecapital.com. My guest today is Billy Guthrie, Senior Social Security Disability Attorney at Duderman Law Group in Durham. Billy has practiced Social Security disability law for more than a decade, and before she became an attorney, she worked in the mental health field as an administrator and a social worker. She will be a presenter at NCAJ's upcoming day-long CLE, Social Security Disability, Updates and Practical Pointers for 2025 and Beyond. Her topic is how to strengthen cases involving mental health impairments and substance use. That CLE is on September 19 at NCAJ headquarters in Raleigh. It's the kickoff to our fall season of in-person member-led CLE programming. You can learn more and register for that program and find out about all the other great CLEs we have planned for this year at ncaj.com/events. Billy, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
So your career has taken some very interesting twists and turns. Tell me about how you started out as a social worker.
So like my first job?
Yeah. Well, what made you decide to become a social worker to begin with?
So I don't know exactly. Some of these questions are hard because, I was young and whimsical, like most young people are, but I had a special flair for it. And sometimes the universe just landed me where I was meant to be, I think. But I jumped around undergraduate schools, trying to figure out my path. And I grew up in a college town, thankfully. So I went to Virginia Tech until my mother would not let me leave school. I wanted to do a gap year. She was having none of it. I was the first person in my family to go to college, in my immediate family. And she, I think, was very afraid of me losing that opportunity or diverting from the path that she had. So I stayed at Virginia Tech till I figured out what I wanted to do. And so I was intentional. I went to Appalachian State and I got a bachelor's of social work, which was a pretty specific degree. It wasn't a basic human services. So I did have a clear path in mind. I also knew at that point, if I got my bachelor's in social work, that very specific bachelor's degree, I could get an expedited master's. Like you basically get kind of fast-tracked for an MSW, which I did end up doing. But I don't know. I've always had this really kind of strong sense of right and wrong, and at least in my own head, what is right, what is wrong. And I certainly think people taking care of people, it felt right to me. Systems taking care of people felt right to me, kind of laying the groundwork in communities so that people weren't falling through the cracks. My mother, I don't know, God bless her. I don't know how she came out of her family the way she did, but she was very loving, very non-judgmental. We came from some pretty Appalachian roots. And so she taught me about universal love and about helping people. And so I knew I wanted to do that in some form or fashion. And I directed my education in a way that I could do that and make a living doing it.
When you say Appalachian roots, you mean poverty or dysfunction or all of the above?
So I grew up in Blacksburg. So, there is a college university there, but don't let that fool you. When people find out I grew up in Blacksburg, they go, oh, you're a local. It is mountainous. It is pretty blue collar, except for the university. I grew up with a single mother and we struggled with money. And then, I think that there can be a lot of, I don't want to speak ill of where I grew up because it's beautiful and the people are kind and loving, but there was a lot of closed-mindedness where I grew up and a lot of kind of easy assumptions about where people end up in their lives, whether it's in poverty or in homelessness or in drug addiction or with mental health issues, that was somehow a choice. And so that's what I mean. And my mother, for some reason, just sort of knew better despite all of the influences she had. And she instilled that in me, like a non-judgmental approach to people's circumstances.
Mm. Do you remember a time in during your undergraduate education when you found out that, or you realized that social work was your path? Was there a particular professor or a particular class or experience where you were like, ah, this is the answer. This is why I'm here to do this.
I don't know if it was that like aha moment. I think it was the culmination of a bunch of life experiences and a bunch of like taking a step back from being a young woman and wanting to do whatever I wanted to do in terms of being whimsical and free-spirited and realizing like I needed some sort of like practical plan going forward. And social work was most closely aligned with my values and where I could see myself investing my life. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what social work was exactly, but I knew that it was rooted in social justice and it was rooted in compassion and it was rooted in values that really aligned with mine and continue to align with my values. So,
and so did you start out like as a, I don't know if the terms are a field worker,
yeah.
Like, were you like dealing with clients one-on-one?
Yeah, I've done a lot of, so when you get your master's, they separate you based on your interest in like sort of direct and clinical work or what we called macro. So before I got my master's, like you take all kinds of jobs, which I did. If you want a funny story, I'll give you one.
Yes, I would love a funny story.
One of my very first jobs, I was still in Boone because I ended up going from Blacksburg to Appalachian State in Boone. It was really way, way far out in some pretty rural, isolated mountain town. And it was with like 16, 17, 18 year olds that had been removed from their homes and put into like skilled foster care settings. So they weren't just in homes. We were in a home environment. And it was, I think they were called teaching parents. I'm not sure. I forget. It was a long time ago. But 16, 17 year olds, and here I am like 20, 21, you know, there's not a lot of age difference. And the parents were there, and it was based on a evidence-based model around, there were all these points, like you would give them points for good behavior, deduct points for bad behavior. And I've just never been good at stuff like that consistent, but I did that okay. The long story short is I would go on the weekends and like give them some respite, the parents some respite. And I was a total pushover. I was a complete pushover. They ended up stealing the van for me because I took them to church. And then I stopped off at my second job to get a paycheck. I waited tables on the side right near the church.
Oh my gosh.
And I left it running because it was the winter. And they took it and they were gone.
Oh my God.
Was horrendous. It was a horrendous experience. It taught me a lot.
Wow.
But I don't think I ate or slept for like 3 days until we found them. I helped the Wilkes County police like look for them.
They were gone for 3 days?
Oh yeah, it was bad.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, you live and you learn. I realized then that like young adults when I was that age was probably not a good population for me to work with. My very first like real job was why I came down to this area. And it was for an organization called Club Nova. And It's a psychiatric rehabilitation program for adults living with severe and persistent mental illness. So the primary clients of our organization lived with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, or really severe bipolar 1 disorder. And I loved it. And it's still, that population is probably, and I don't like to call people populations, but for simplicity's sake, it's still really, it's really special for me to help people living with those severe mental illnesses. They're challenging to diagnose, they're challenging to treat, and it's certainly challenging to like be in this world when you have moments where you may not be connected to this reality. So they are a program that is actually international. It's really beautiful. If any of the listeners are interested, if you look it up, it's based on a clubhouse model. It's international. They have clubhouses in Japan and Switzerland. It's the same model. Each member of the program, there's like a bill of rights. So their dignity and respect is really, really important. There's no real hierarchy. There are staff, but the members make decisions, part of everyday decisions of running the program. And I actually spent about like 8 years on the board of their sister program in Durham. I just stepped down last year. So that program really touched me. That model really touched me. I think it is empowering. I think it is special. And it can really save people's lives. So I was really honored to work with them for a number of years.
So how did you go from, clearly you have a heart for personal service and interactive with individuals. How did you go from that to evolving your career to policy and becoming a policy advocate and then moving into eventually to going on to law school? What was that process like?
So at Club Nova, actually, the director, who's still a dear friend of mine, and I'm not kidding when I say I wound up in places that I was meant to be because she was a mentor to me. And she was really, really into empowerment. So like people who have to rely on social systems should be educated about them and try to impact them and to try to bring life to policy, right? Like this is how your policy that you made in that room with those other people who don't live with this affect me. And so we started doing advocacy early on when I started with members. So we would take members to the legislature or to city hall meetings and have conversations. And that was my first exposure and I really loved it. And I knew I wanted to get my master's eventually just to open doors. And like I said at the beginning, when I began my master's program, they had us decide, like, do you want to work clinically with people? Do you want to be an LCSW? Do you want to do therapy? Or do you want to do more policy-based work, community organizing? And I chose the latter. And then that opened doors for me so that my work from thereafter was running programs. So that was kind of the administrative aspect, but also I had some really great gigs where I got to do some really fun and really innovative policy advocacy.
What were some of those?
Like the two that were most influential to me was I was one of the original organizers of the Chapel Hill or Orange County Partnership to End Homelessness. So we were, you know, it wasn't called that when we did it. It was called the Continuum of Care. It was something we had to have in place in our community to receive funding from the Housing and Urban Development. So it had been really pro forma, like a couple people would get together from the mental health organization in the city or the town and maybe housing once a year, said they did this, get the funding. And we really wanted to enhance that and start looking at how we could address housing issues, particularly homelessness and lack of affordable housing in the Orange County area. So we started that process in earnest. And I was a baby, but that's what I was doing. I was calling members of the town council, the mayor. Kevin Foy was the mayor at the time. He ended up teaching me torts, actually. So I had an ongoing relationship with him. We brought in homeless people for their perspective. They were members of that committee.
About what time was this? What year?
Why do I not know this?
Like early 2000s or early?
Yeah, because I mean, I got my master's in 03 and I did have my master's then. So, and now it's a really vibrant, thriving committee. But, you know, we brought in folks from UNC hospitals and started, you know, assessing the community. We did a community assessment, I think with the public health students, excuse me. But anyhow, that was one of my first sort of looking at community organizing / policy advocacy. One of my next jobs, it was so wonderful. It was a project called Reclaiming Futures. And it was looking at like integration of the juvenile mental health system with the juvenile justice system. And so like we were then at that point going to state level policymakers and talking about the preschool to prison pipeline, you know, like how treatment of young people who may be justice involved and also exhibiting mental health issues or addiction issues or have family members with those, or, you know, come from family of origins with those issues, like, this is the path they're set on. And like, we can change it or we can let it keep going in this direction. And any of the policy advocacy I've ever done, you have to speak the language, right? And so we don't, the reason I don't want that is because we're human beings. Why would we want to set people up for failure? But it's also way more expensive. So in housing work, that's also what we did. We said, leave these folks unsheltered with acute psychiatric crises. You're going to pay more with jails and institutions than you are if you just put a roof over their heads. So yeah, those were some of my experiences. I miss it, talking about it.
Wow. So what pushed you towards making the jump and going to law school?
It's a hard question. Like, honest God, my mom said, he always said you were going to be a lawyer. You were just spunky like that and fiery. And she said, I said that. We'll have to ask her if that's true or not.
Can we get your mom?
Yeah, right. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to be more knowledgeable and more effective. And the work that I did in communities helping people, I was also interested, intellectually interested in the law.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you just took that next step.
Yeah. I mean, I took the LSAT. I just took it one step at a time because I was working full time. I worked all the way through law school. I went to Central's evening program, which is an amazing program. It was probably the hardest 4 years of my entire life. But, you know, I just took it one step at a time. I said, I'm going to take the LSATs, see what happens there. Did okay. Okay, well, I don't want to quit my job. I love my job. I also can't afford to quit my job and just be a student again. You know, I was a little bit older. I wasn't super old at that point. Not that I'm super old now, but you know what I mean? I was still in my 20s, I think.
Right.
Or like
right.
Coming up on 30s. And so I said, well, I'm going to apply to one school. I'm going to apply to Central's evening program. Let's see if I get in, because it's fairly competitive, I think. And I got in and then I just did it. And I remember panicking like that first week. Like, I didn't know what I was reading. It felt like a foreign language. And then I just said, like, okay, well, one semester at a time. If it has to be that way, then it'll be that way. But I did end up loving it.
So once you got into the practice of law, how did you stay connected to the, was it easy to stay connected to the like personal, to serving clients, I guess, as a legal practitioner in the same way that it was as doing the kind of work you were talking about earlier in your career? What's the difference between serving clients as a lawyer, serving people as a lawyer, and serving people as a social worker in the way that you did in the earlier parts of your career?
Yeah, so it's interesting because when I was working in more direct settings, one of the motivators to get into policy or the law was like the confines of those systems and helping people, right? And I saw, well, this person's success in the community is only going to go so far if our systems are set up in the way that they're set up. So that was my interest in going into policy. So then I was working on that sort of larger scale, but through my education in the law, I've come back to that kind of one-on-one, one case at one time. I think the difference is, and I think I'm actually better suited as an attorney, because the difference is as a social worker, I felt like I had to help with everything. And I can get drawn into that a lot, that acknowledging that like there are so many factors at play in my clients' struggles, like access to healthcare, access to transportation, those kinds of things. But I always remind myself, and I, especially when I was in private practice and I was a lot more hands-on because I didn't have staff support, you know, I have to remind myself and sometimes my clients, my time is so much better spent focusing on your disability case and how I can help you get these benefits that you deserve, instead of sort of troubleshooting all the challenges that come along with being chronically ill or chronically mentally ill, living in poverty, sort of not thriving in the systems that we have currently. So I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, definitely. I've had conversations before with attorneys who started out doing Social Security disability work as part of a larger practice. And I remember them telling me that those Social Security disability cases were some of those first ones when they were first coming along, were some of the most rewarding and most personally satisfying cases that they've ever had, you know, because you can really make a difference.
Yeah, it's a tangible difference.
In a person's life.
Yeah, it's a tangible. I mean, I had a hearing this morning with a young woman who very much needed these benefits. And we got her case approved on the record, meaning I wrote the judge, I put forth our arguments and the evidence and the medical records that supported those arguments and said, hey, judge, any chance you'd be willing to award this case without making her go through a hearing? Hearings can be traumatic. They can be stressful. Sometimes I think it's pretty clear and I'll ask a judge for basically to weigh in on that. And she didn't know. I was calling her to give her the good news that we didn't have to have her hearing later today. And she said, I need to talk to you. You know, things are not working out where I'm staying. I'm going to be homeless. And I got to say, hang tight. Couple more weeks, you're going to have some resources that will get you out of that living situation that is, you know, worsening your conditions and your mental health. So it is a very tangible change. And before Medicaid was expanded in North Carolina, SSI came with health insurance, which, you know, we may end up back with, you know, back to the environment where we don't have expanded Medicaid. So opening the doors in terms of healthcare and addressing chronic issues that will hopefully not only improve quality of life, but help people live longer and better. With SSDI, there comes Medicare. So yeah, it's pretty tangible, the differences you can help effectuate for someone.
So you bring worlds of experience to your cases, to your practice, given everything that you've done as a social worker and then as a policy advocate, and now with your experience practicing. And you're going to share a lot of that, or some of that, an hour's worth anyway, with the folks who attend our CLE coming up on September 19th. What are some of the things that you're going to focus on and that folks can expect to hear you talk about in this upcoming CLE?
Well, I technically have, I think, like 8 days to figure that out. So, but I am still in process. I mean, my stepsister is a very, very skilled clinician. She's actually got her MSW. She's an LCSW. My very best friend growing up is an LCSW. I spoke with one of them yesterday and speaking again tonight, my sister. So I'm gathering information about what do I tell people who are pretty seasoned practitioners? What are some things they might not know, right? And so I'm also, if you're listening to this and the CLE hasn't happened and you're attending and you want to know something and you maybe haven't had time to research it, like shoot me an email, because I do want to utilize the hour that I have and not just spout out regulations to really smart people who know the regulations, right? So trying to get information from clinicians that I know, trying to draw on my own history to present some strategies. Social Security is really big on the requirement of objective evidence that an impairment exists, right? So my back hurts. I do an MRI of my lumbar spine, and now I can connect the dots. We don't have that with mental health issues. We don't. Maybe. That's one of the things why I'm talking to my clinician friends. They're like, what are the objective tools that you all use? And how can we push our clients to maybe have their psychiatrists or mental health teams employ some of those, since Social Security is still wanting it, you know, to verify how bad is someone's mental illness. I think another issue that I would like to focus on, because one of my dear colleagues reached out to me, is like, how do we help people with mental illness explain their mental illness when maybe they don't think they have a mental illness and, you know, they're being asked by a judge something that they may or may not have insight into. So some strategies around interviewing and eliciting testimony. And then also there's these little nuggets in some of our rulings, the Social Security rulings on this subject that I want to point out that I often use. Because of my background, I spent a lot of time giving presentations to psychiatrists and mental health teams and clinicians around, you know, if you want to help your client, here's how. And so I think I will probably share some of the insight that I've gotten through those conversations. And like, how do we ask mental health providers to get on board and to help us help their clients? So yeah.
That sounds great. Nuggets.
Nuggets.
Everybody loves nuggets. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, that sounds really promising. I think that you've got 8 days, and if you can like boil all that down to like 55 or 1 hour's worth of CLE, then it'll be terrific.
You know, I have no problem presenting this information to doctors. Doctors are a little scary, but they're not especially scary to me. The lawyers scare me. So luckily we have a really, I think, supportive community of North Carolina disability attorneys. It's one of the things I've really loved through my work with NCAJ is meeting the people in our community and finding out what fine folk they are. But they do scare me a little bit because they are smart. So we'll see.
Well, that's good. That's good. Scary and smart, but supportive and friendly. maybe we should change our motto or our mission statement. Perfect. Well, Billy, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I have really enjoyed talking to you, and I am looking forward to seeing you at the CLE on September 19th.
All right. Thank you so much.
Billy will be presenting at NCAJ's Social Security Disability CLE on September 19th at NCAJ headquarters in Raleigh. Her topic is how to strengthen cases involving mental health impairments and substance use. Learn more about that CLE and register for it, and learn more about the rest of our great fall CLE programming at ncaj.com/events. Before we go, I'd like to thank our Circle of Leadership program sponsors, Abrams & Abrams, Henson First, the Law Offices of James Scott Farron, the Law Offices of John McCabe, Whitley Law Firm, Brown Moore & Associates, Edwards Kirby, Johnson & Groninger, DeMaio Law Offices, the Law Offices of Wallace & Graham, Horton & Mendez Injury Attorneys, Kuntz & Smith, the Law Offices of Jason E. Taylor, Sumwalt Group Workers' Comp and Trial Lawyers, and Orndorff Law Firm. These firms are supporting NCAJ's mission as founding members of the Circle of Leadership at the Gemstone level. Find out how your firm can join the Circle of Leadership at ncaj.com/circle. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Voices of NCAJ. For more information on the North Carolina Advocates for Justice and how to join or support NCAJ, please visit our website at www.ncaj.com.